Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free.
From Wondery. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm all right. Tonight's going to be a little different, isn't it, Aaron? We're going to do something we normally don't do on our main feed. This is sort of in light of some events that have happened lately. You know, anytime someone goes missing, it's tragic, regardless of ethnicity, gender, or social status. Thousands of people go missing every year. People of color make up almost 40% of that number. And I hope that we can maybe shed some light and give some of those attention, right?
Well, that's the goal.
One more thought on that. I mean, I honestly think that CSI and crime shows give us an unrealistic expectation of what law enforcement's response is going to be. I mean, if you go out and fill out a police report, I think most people believe that the police are going to jump right on it, sound the alarms, and send out the troops. But in a lot of cases, they're just filling out a police report. And then that's going to get filed away and assigned to somebody eventually. They're going to determine the severity of the situation. This could take days.
Well, and the other thing to mention is that if you're not getting the results that you want, there may be that idea that law enforcement isn't trying hard enough to find your missing loved one, even if they are. Or maybe they're just going about it in a way that you wouldn't have done it.
Absolutely. Because most of us don't know the process. Because most of us, thankfully, don't have a missing loved one. Most of us, thankfully, don't have to call 911. We don't know what happens because we've never done it. And then we have this expectation of what should happen or what we would do. And that's not always the case.
So let's start with the first case, and that is the case of Jelani Day. August 24, 2021, Peru, Illinois, Jelani Day's car, wallet, clothing, and lanyard were found. He had gone missing. What do we know about Jelani Day?
Well, he was 25 years old. He was a grad student at ISU. He had his life together. He was very successful in everything he was doing. He was going to school. He was trying to get a degree and fulfill his dreams. He had graduated from Alabama A&M and had an undergraduate degree in speech language pathology. He was also a member of Omega Sci-Fi fraternity. He wasn't the type of person to go missing. Let's just say that.
And he was goal-driven. His dream was to become a doctor, hence all of the schooling. His full name was Jelani Jesse Javante Day. So what we do know is that August 24, 2021 was the last time that he was seen. And he was in the area because he was visiting family.
They reported him missing the next day on the 25th because he hadn't shown up for class and no one had heard from him. The police put out a missing persons notice describing him, 25 years old, 6'2", 180 pounds, short black hair, brown eyes, some facial hair, and he drove a white 2010 Chrysler 300. Now, as you said, they find this car fairly quickly, right?
Well, they found his car fairly quickly because it was on August 26th when his car was located in a wooded area. This was near the Illinois Valley YMCA. Peru is 60 miles north of Bloomington, where he was from. So the police conduct a search in that area around that car and then later send it in for processing.
Now, they said that the vehicle looked like it was concealed in a wooded area. Now, I don't know if that's just parked deep into the woods or if that means somebody had actually taken branches and put it all over the car, but they used the word concealed, which to me means hidden from public view. The license plate had been removed and the keys were also missing.
Jelani's wallet and his lanyard that he used at ISU were found near his car, as well as some of his clothing, which was found inside the car. So they had some evidence that they collected that they were going to send to ISP Forensic Labs. They included swabs of the driver and passenger side interior door handles, a swab of the steering wheel, a blue straw, and a partially smoked cigar. Well, I think the key here is they're just testing these commonly used areas in case either Jelani or someone else had driven the car there, then they would get some evidence of that.
And obviously, this is very suspicious because it doesn't appear that robbery was the motive because they found a lot of his stuff in his wallet.
So you might wonder, what do the police make of this? Bloomington Public Information Officer John Furman made this statement. It's suspicious or unusual circumstances while he was missing. And then the car's location also, you know, pretty suspicious or unusual. And I've been a police officer 10 years. That's very unusual to just find a car like that. So the indication from the police is possibly foul play.
They're trying to pull records. They're trying to pull security camera footage. And they get some footage from the ISU's Bone Student Center. At 7:20 a.m. on August 24th, he was captured on camera wearing a blue button-up, black pants, black dress shoes, and a blue face mask. His car was seen in the school parking lot at 7 a.m. This is fairly normal.
August 31st, police obtained videos of Jelani at a cannabis dispensary. He was captured on their security footage at 9:12 a.m. on August 24th. He was wearing a Detroit Lions baseball hat, Jimi Hendrix band shirt, white or silver shorts, and black shoes. His vehicle was captured in the parking lot. This clothing that he had on was what was found inside of his car. So again, this is just about a week later that they got this footage of him.
Still, nothing really outlandish here. Just he was at a dispensary. He was wearing some different clothes, which, hey, he's going to change into his regular civilian clothes, whatever you want to call them, his casual clothing, because he's not going to wear what he wears to class. He's not going to wear what he normally wears on a day-to-day basis. So not that big of a deal to me. But it's several days later before they end up finding him.
Well, during this time, his family had been pushing as hard as they could on media, social media, you know, with the news stations, etc., trying to get people to help them figure out what happened to Jelani. But, you know, for them, nothing can happen fast enough. This is their loved one. And again, this is a guy that's motivated and reliable. So they know that every day that goes by, the chances of something terrible happening just get more and more likely. And on September 4th, 2021, the police received a tip. And this tip told them that there was a body floating near the south bank of the Illinois River. That's about a quarter mile east of the Illinois TR-251 bridge. And this body was found at 9:47 in the morning, about 1 mile away from Jelani's abandoned car. So the coroner's office, at the time, all they could do was confirm that the body that was discovered was male, but they didn't want to release any other information, probably because they didn't have much more information. So their next step was they needed to go to Jelani's family on September 6th and collect DNA samples. That way they could compare the body to the family. Jelani's mother also gave the coroner Jelani's dental records. And it took quite a number of days for all this information to be compared.
And Carmen Day just feels like this investigation is just moving as slow as molasses. She feels like after they found this body, she's not getting any answers. And when she speaks to the detective, she felt as if there was a lack of enthusiasm. That's what I was referring to earlier. Maybe there was, or maybe this is just another body that's found and he is investigating it and he doesn't have any information for her. Could go a lot of different ways.
In the meantime, while the family's waiting for information about this body, the police announced that this investigation into the body was separate from the Jelani Day investigation. And it was the day after that, on September 8th, when the Day family lawyer contacted the sheriff's office. They wanted a meeting because they wanted to know what information should be released to the public. After all, whatever you can get out to the public that would help and not hurt the investigation should be getting out.
Their whole point was they wanted to go public with this, get people to give them tips, you know, call-ins, and they were going to offer a $25,000 reward for his safe return. They also were starting a GoFundMe campaign, and they don't want to cause issues with the investigation by putting something out there that maybe the public shouldn't know. But again, they're asking the police department, what should we say? And they're not getting much of a response.
Now, why do you think that the Day family believes that this investigation slowed way down after this body was discovered? Do you think it's because, despite the police saying the investigations were separate, that deep down they felt, well, if they have them, now they just have to wait on forensics, and so there's not much else to do but wait?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, is I don't know what the police told Jelani's family, but it sounds like they didn't say, hey, thank you for providing us with DNA and dental records. It takes days, if not weeks, to get these things analyzed and sent back. They probably just said, hey, thanks, and then no contact. Who knows how that conversation went, but we know that nothing moves fast when it comes to, you know, DNA analysis and stuff. It's not instantaneous the way it appears to be on TV. But they really need to convey that to a family. Say, hey, we sent this off. We're waiting for the results.
Well, right. The conversation could have been less enthusiastic than what they were hoping. Or maybe they felt like they should be giving them many more updates. Like, we're doing this, we're running these leads down, whatever. But for whatever reason, especially Jelani's mother felt that it's almost like things slowed way down after the discovery of this body. September 20th, the Bloomington Police Department asked the public for more information, and Jelani's sisters appeared in an interview with NBC affiliate WAND. And obviously, Carmen had done many interviews asking for the public's help. She wanted to know what happened to her son. But September 23rd, the police finally publicly confirmed that the body in the river was Jelani Day. They didn't release a cause of death at that time, though. What we know about Jelani's body is that it was very deteriorated from being in the water. And the officials who went on record said it could take quite a long time to figure out what actually happened to Jelani. They said it took 4 dental practices to identify Jelani's remains. And they said that the DNA was a match. They used a bone sample from Jelani to compare that DNA to Jelani's family, and it was a match. The public information officer I mentioned earlier, John Furman, he could not say why it took so long to identify the body, but he said there was a significant backlog at the Illinois State Crime Lab. And that's where, when you mention CSI can give people unrealistic expectations, that's why. Because as much as a number of people would want to know what happened to Jelani, they can't push his sample ahead of everyone else that's in line at this state crime lab. You join a queue and you have to wait.
We always talk about police budgets and how they want to put more patrol officers on the street, but I guess it's not sexy to increase a budget to get rid of the backlog of all the DNA evidence, all of the rape kits that they've collected, all of those things to actually solve the crimes that they've initially investigated. That doesn't really ever seem to be in budget talks or at the forefront of anyone's conversation.
So the county coroner performed the first autopsy. And one of obviously the first questions anyone would have is, did it appear to be a homicide? And what this county coroner said was, there was no evidence of antemortem injury, such as manual strangulation, an assault or altercation, sharp, blunt, or gunshot injury, infection, tumor, natural disease, congenital abnormality, or significant drug intoxication. A common thing that happens, Justin, in missing persons cases where a body is eventually found is we often hear about missing organs.
Yeah.
And that was a rumor that was going around in Jelani Day's case as well, but the county coroner said that was not true. He said the exam was suboptimal because of the degree of decomposition and the activity of river predators.
They finally got the toxicology report. He had caffeine, nicotine, and cannabis in his system. His cause of death was drowning with no signs of struggle. So he just went into the water voluntarily or was placed into the water while he was alive. They're not really saying anything other than he was in the water and that was his cause of death.
And that doesn't tell us much, does it? Because just because there's no signs of a struggle doesn't mean that he wasn't pushed into the water or something.
And apparently he was an avid swimmer and he was actually on the high school swim team. So he's not going into the water for a swim, especially in this like place that he was at. Also, this is somewhat insinuating that this was suicide. Although they don't say that, it's sort of inferred.
Because of that, his mother Carmen was insulted by this conclusion. She said that her son was not depressed. He had no pressures on him that would make him want to get away from it all. She said he's strong-willed, he was strong-minded. So she believes, deep down, that her son must have been murdered. Now, before we go on, Justin, it's one thing for a coroner to take whatever evidence they have and to come to a conclusion, but did they really factor in everything? Because I think back to the car and how the car was missing its plates. That's very suspicious to me. What happened to those plates? Why would you remove the plates off of your car and then hide it?
It's out of sorts and that, yeah.
All I'm saying is before anybody jumps to conclusions based on the coroner's report, I think we need to give the Day family some respect here because I don't think they're coming to any conclusions out of, you know, denial. I think they're really looking at this and thinking, why would this happen? Why would that happen? How could he just drown if he was such a good swimmer? But of course, on the other side, you have the coroner's office saying, well, we don't see any signs of a struggle. We don't see any possibility that he was, say, knocked out and thrown in the river, anything like that. So they're going with what information they have. Although I still think that the car being hidden the way it was is extremely suspicious.
Yeah, the bigger picture here doesn't exactly say suicide.
So Jelani's family hired a pathologist to perform another autopsy. And Dr. Jane Bryant said the condition and state of the body made Jelani nearly unrecognizable. So we already said there were problems with the body simply because it had been in the water for so long. But Dr. Bryant said they had never seen a body as destroyed as Jelani's.
As most situations happen, let's say you, I don't mean this in a flippant way, but like you say, you call a plumber or you call an electrician or you call somebody to do something at your house. They're always going to come in and they're going to look at the way it's set up and they're going to criticize how the last person did it because they wouldn't have done it that way. And this pathologist is going to say, you know, the name tag was on the body bag, not a toe tag. He's like, I have a problem with this. He was totally unidentifiable. What if they put the wrong body in the wrong bag? This is why you put a tag on the body and not the bag. He's criticizing and finding issues with the original autopsy, which I think anyone's going to do.
Well, not just that, but there's also a suspicion here on the part of this pathologist that maybe someone had desecrated Jelani's body and that made it more susceptible to damage in the water than it otherwise would have been.
Yeah.
So in other words, maybe that first coroner, that first pathologist just got it wrong, didn't see this for what it was. So that's pretty common, I think, when you have two different pathologists, one who works for the county and one who works for the family.
But she's not done there, is she, Aaron?
No, she said this. She said there were contradicting facts from the first preliminary autopsy compared to the second. And she said, but this is not a case of organ harvesting. However, my son did not put himself in a river. So this is all part of the search to figure out what happened to Jelani Day. And again, it took four different dentists, essentially, to make a match with the dental records.
And she calls for a third autopsy of his body, which just kind of reconfirms a lot of the previous findings.
In other words, there wasn't any revelations to be had here. I mean, what it comes down to is the body's in very bad shape. And depending on which pathologist does the autopsy, they'll either expect that from where the body was found, or they might question what happened to the body before it was found because it's even more damaged than they would have expected. Now, they get kind of a break in the case in November. The county sheriff's office announced that they had found Jelani's cell phone on November 15th of 2021, but it was actually found on October 17th. The sheriff's office decided to delay their press release about this. Now, the background is there was a man that found Jelani's phone near an exit along the side of an interstate when he stopped to reposition a mattress on his truck. So he stopped his truck, got out, and was messing with that mattress, and he saw this shattered phone. So he took it to a Walmart to turn it in for cash, and he got $80 for it. You know, a few days after that, the Bloomington Police Department contacted the man and told him that phone you turned in was Jelani Day's cell phone. So the police, they're able to turn this phone on. It was damaged, but it came on, and one of Jelani's alarms went off when they did. So this phone was sent off to the FBI to be analyzed. But Carmen, she didn't learn about her son's cell phone until November 11th. And she learned about it from a Facebook post written by a friend of the guy who had found the phone. So she called the Bloomington Police Department and asked about it. And they said, yes, it's true. Your son's phone was found. But they said, we waited to tell you because we really wanted to be sure it was his phone. And according to Carmen, the reason they sent it off to the FBI is because she requested that. She wanted the FBI looking into this phone and not the police.
Yeah, because she's already frustrated with the response she's gotten from them.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
There are some stories about my mom's life that I truly never get tired of hearing. Just in time for Mother's Day, I found the perfect gift that captures all her stories for my family forever. It's called StoryWorth. StoryWorth helps you preserve precious memories and stories from your mom or grandmother for years to come. Each week, StoryWorth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. What was your favorite toy as a child? Or what's your favorite memory of your grandmother? All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. After a year of responses, StoryWorth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. My mom completed her story, and each of her kids now has a copy to read and share with their kids. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll cherish for years. StoryWorth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/GenY. That's storyworth.com/GenY to save $10 on your first purchase. So we talked before about how the family, they really don't think the police are as focused on this case as they should be, as they ought to be. And the Reverend Jesse Jackson and his Rainbow Push Coalition led a march in Peru for Jelani, which went along the path where his car and belongings were found. And they were pushing for other agencies to take over this case. And I think what they were asking for was for the FBI to lead the investigation. Jelani's fraternity also got involved and started a petition for federal and state authorities to get involved. And at the time, it had over 28,000 signatures. The FBI, they are not announcing that they're getting involved, right? They said that they've had communications with the Bloomington police. But since they don't know that a federal crime has occurred, they're not exactly ready to take this case over.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they're speaking to the Bloomington Police Department, and that police department saying, here's our investigation, here's what we've done, and it's according to policy and procedure, and there's, at least on paper, probably not a problem. And the FBI is saying, well, there's not much for us to do because you're already doing it. They're just not telling the family. They're just not giving the response that we as the public expect.
November 18th, 2021, the LaSalle County Sheriff's Office wanted to, I guess, clear the air. There's this idea that perhaps not enough agencies are involved or the right ones. So they released 300 documents from September 1st through October 15th that confirmed that more than 12 agencies were involved in the investigation. These included the Peru Police Department, Bloomington Police Department, Peru Crime Lab, Bloomington Crime Lab, the FBI's BAU, and the Illinois Search and Rescue Council. They said there would be more records to be released, but they asked for a 30-day extension because they couldn't locate all of the rest of the documents.
Which, again, they can't locate all the documents. It's like, come on. It's just like, this is a fresh case. This isn't a case from 10 or 20 years ago. This is current. And that just, you know, it just shows that, again, our expectations of law enforcement are pretty high compared to the reality.
Well, with so many agencies involved, it can be difficult to get all those documents together because it's not like they're sharing a database where they just put all their information in and it's easily obtained. Now, one of the fears that families who are involved in cases like this have are that a coroner's report, an autopsy, can make it seem like their loved one took their own life when they really believe that didn't happen. So December 3rd, Ben Crump called the FBI to investigate the death as a hate crime. And according to Crump, his primary mission here is to make it clear that Jelani Day did not take his own life. And so Crump is asking for the U.S. Attorney General and the FBI to take control of the case. The FBI responded to this, Justin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're finally getting the FBI's attention, right?
Well, yeah. And their response was basically, hey, we're in communication with the Peru Police Department, and we are providing resources as needed. But because they're in an active investigation, the Department of Justice policy prevented them from further commenting on the matter. So really, Justin, what this comes down to is this young man goes missing, and then his vehicle is found, his body is found, and there's this question out there of what happened to Jelani Day. And as far as I know, Jelani is very much a matter of debate these days about what happened to him. What is your take on this?
It's so hard when his vehicle is found, like hidden in the woods with the license plates removed. That to me screams foul play. That doesn't scream he took his own life, because at that point, like, why would anyone do that? If he drove himself out there and for whatever reason decided that he was going to jump into a creek or a river, and like, why would he take the time to stage the scene? Why would he take the time to remove his plates? Like, at what point do we balance out the lack of evidence of stab wounds or gunshot wounds to the state of his vehicle? And can we even rule out that he didn't have any wounds on his body when his body was found in such a state? I think it should be left as undetermined.
It can hurt an investigation if there are law enforcement officers, anyone else working this case, and their primary data shows that this person took their own life. What is their motivation to work real hard on this case to solve it? That's the question I have. I understand everyone has a job, and maybe some people can do their job and not worry about the bigger picture. They'll just say, this case needs to be solved and I'll do my best.
Yeah.
Right? But is that likely? I don't know.
Yeah. You would think that there is this triaging, this prioritizing of homicides to suicides or homicides to an armed robbery, whatever it is.
I have a lot of different thoughts on this, but I think in the end, it comes down to one thing for me. I can look at the car and I can see that the plates are missing. I can see that he has items that aren't all found together. They're found in different places. It's all very suspicious. He's a great swimmer and yet he drowns. His family swears up and down he's not suicidal. There's one thing that I can't shake that makes me think if I had to go down on one side or the other on this, I would fall on the side of homicide. I think this was foul play. And that is Ariel Davis, Day's cousin. She has spoken with the media and she swears up and down that there's no way that Jelani would disappear, that he would abandon his dad because his dad has cancer. And Jelani is the bone marrow match for him.
So he just essentially left his father out in the cold if he did this. Yeah.
But it doesn't make sense to me. If he's the match, why would he do this? We can get into a lot of different things, but there's nothing to suggest that he would have done this, gone to all these lengths and left his dad like that because his dad needed him. There's a Chicago Sun-Times journalist named John W. Fountain, and he wrote a 3-part series on Jelani's case, and I'd urge everyone to read it. But one thing he gets into is he says that Peru is a sundown town, and he thinks that only a local from there would know about this spot in the woods where Jelani's car was found. He said, what are the chances that Jelani would drive to Peru, park his car a mile from the river, remove his clothing, and just get into the water and drown himself?
It's unlikely. It's not impossible, but it's highly improbable.
They need to start somewhere with forensic evidence. And so far, there just hasn't been anything forthcoming. You know, Have you heard anything, Justin, about fingerprints or DNA, any of that?
No, not at all.
So I understand why the family is frustrated and why they feel like not enough was done. But unfortunately, this is a mystery. And all we can hope for is that the more people that hear about it, eventually maybe someone will come forward and say, I saw Jelani that day, right?
Absolutely.
That's one reason why you have officers going to different businesses and asking for their security footage, because they can build a timeline. But if you only have footage from that morning, that's not going to be enough. There are hours of missing time here where we just don't know what was going on. But robbery did not seem to be a motive here. And I guess, you know, if you ask, why is Ben Crump trying to turn this into a hate crime case? Well, if it wasn't a motive of robbery, then what was it?
We can look at sundown laws and sundown towns and think, well, that was a long time ago and this is a different world. But it's human nature to expect people to respond or expect the government to respond based on a pattern of behavior. And when that has been the pattern of behavior, why would anyone, especially a person of color, think that things have changed or expect anything different?
Statistics show that only 0.4% of Peru is African American.
Now, Aaron, the case that caught my eye was Daniel Robinson. He was last seen on the morning of June 23rd, 2021. He was leaving a work site in Buckeye, Arizona. He was a 24-year-old geologist. This work site was in a fairly remote area because when you're studying rocks and terrain and whatnot, you're not going to be in the middle of a city. You're going to be out in the middle of the desert, which he was. He left his job site in a 2017 Jeep Renegade, and it's believed that he was heading west. Daniel Robinson, ever since his childhood, he had done everything that he had put his mind to. Now, he had a birth defect. He was born with only one hand. And Daniel's father, David Robinson, says that never held him back on anything he wanted to achieve. He was able to play musical instruments. He would beat his siblings in video games. And eventually, he went on to graduate with honors and become a geologist.
Yeah, he graduated with a major in archaeology and worked as a field geologist or hydrogeologist for Matrix New World Engineering.
And of course, Daniel is a black male. So if you haven't heard of this case, well, you can connect the dots on that one. You know, the news didn't report about this. I've seen some of the interviews they've done with his father, but this is after the fact when people were commenting on Gabby Petito and saying, hey, what about this guy? What about this person? People were saying, hey, we need to highlight this case because this is very weird and suspicious. That morning, Daniel leaves his job site. Now, where he's at, there's not a lot of roads. There's not even a lot of dirt roads. This is sort of open desert. So he's heading west, and that isn't exactly towards the closest road. So his coworker thought that's a little odd.
Well, his coworker, Kenneth Elliott, he thought the whole thing was odd from the get-go because when Daniel had shown up, he tried speaking with him. But he said that Daniel seemed to be kind of lost. He just kept staring out at the desert. Then he abruptly went to his truck. And I guess Kenneth thought, well, he's going to go get something from his truck. But instead of just getting something from his truck, Daniel got in, waved goodbye, and then drove away. And he said that after a bit, he followed the tracks. But it was weird because he, instead of going back towards Phoenix, he was heading the other way. So he was heading off into the desert.
Nobody's heard from Daniel all day. And Daniel's sister will end up calling David, the father, who lives in the Carolinas, you know, pretty much the other side of the country, and tells David, we can't find Daniel. We haven't heard from him. his father will end up calling law enforcement and he puts in a missing persons report. Now, at the time, it's 9 o'clock at night. Law enforcement in that area says, hey, we'll send out a helicopter in the morning when it's daylight hours. So, you know, we'll start a search, which that is a pretty good response. Hey, we'll get on it first thing in the morning. We'll go out searching for him. But when morning rolled around and his father called back to check on how it's going, that's when law enforcement said, your son's an adult. We're not sending out a helicopter. And that didn't sit well with David Robinson.
I don't think it would sit well with anyone. If it's your sibling, if it's your son, daughter, family member, that's not good enough. You want eyes in the sky. I mean, after all, this is a big open desert.
David, he's a veteran. He knows that the first 24 to 48 hours are the most important. And he's looking at this and just going, well, if you're not going to look for my son, then I'm going to look for my son. So he packs his bags and heads west. He's going to come out and look for his son himself because he, again, is not getting the response that he's expecting from law enforcement.
Now, the day that Daniel went missing, the high was about 91 degrees. But as that week went on, the next couple of days got up into the hundreds.
This is the desert, so at night it can get fairly cold. And of course, during the day and unsheltered sun, you're going to be exposed to some pretty extreme temperature changes and the elements. So this isn't a place where you want to be caught out in nature without the proper equipment, gear, or anything. So time is of the essence here.
Now, the Buckeye Police Department did tell David to check his son's social media pages on June 24th. And David confirmed that all of the photos on his son's Instagram had been deleted, which had to have been recent.
Yeah, that's kind of weird because it was 9 o'clock that morning when he had shown up for work and then left 15 minutes later. So
this is a very large desert area. And apparently over time, the Buckeye Police Department says that working with outside agencies, they have searched more than 70 square miles trying to locate Daniel Robinson. They've used UTVs, they've used cadaver dogs, they eventually used air support, including a drone and a helicopter. This information was released on September 16th. Now, Robinson was listed as 5'8 and around 150 to 160 some pounds. He has dark brown eyes and black hair. And as you said, he was born without a right hand. So the support is there, Justin. A lot of people were getting involved to help with this disappearance. But the problem that David Robinson had, that many who were supporting him and his missing son, they were finding that the media wasn't really reporting on this case.
And there's no leads. He's asking law enforcement about his son's cell phone, about tracing his credit cards.
Prior to finding Daniel's vehicle, the police had conducted 4 ground searches and 2 aerial searches. Now, part of their ground searches included sending a robot down 2 different mine shafts, one of which was more than 75 feet deep.
So it sounds like law enforcement is doing searches, is going out there and doing stuff. But again, it took longer than expected. And they are what I'm sure could be perceived as doing their due diligence.
July 19th was when this Jeep Renegade that Daniel Robinson owned was found. It was in a ravine about 4 miles from where he was last seen at that job site. And the car had sustained significant damage.
It was rolled over on its side. The airbags were deployed. Windshield was smashed. It looked like it had gone through a pretty gnarly accident.
Yeah, and this is where they got some good information from the vehicle's black box. They can actually download data from that and figure out possibly what had happened with it. And they discovered that it had been in an accident. They also discovered that there were more than 40 ignition cycles recorded after that crash. Now, these ignition cycles, you'll hear a lot about this if you read up on this case or listen to podcasts or watch YouTube videos. But these would happen if someone was attempting to start the car or if they were even just trying to power the vehicle.
And it's possible that if, for instance, Daniel had been in a wreck and he was, say, pinned inside the vehicle, he could have been turning the vehicle on, maybe to turn on the air conditioner because it's 90 something degrees out. Or if it's nighttime, maybe he's turning it on to warm himself up. But there's another piece of this crash report that they pulled from the Jeep's computer that says the Jeep had been driven several miles. I've read both 7 and 11 miles after the airbags were deployed. Now, David, Daniel's father, he hired his own private investigator because, again, he wasn't happy with the investigation. And there is some discrepancy here. The police department is saying this Jeep was driven after the airbags were deployed, but there could be discrepancies in the way the mileage is reported. Also, the police say that the Jeep sped up right before the crash. So the private investigator disputes this, and he says that there is no indication that the Jeep sped up before the crash, and he's also never heard of any discrepancy in miles, in the mileage reported. He says that he's found one place online where someone talks about that. He's questioning whether or not the police know, and he's actually polling crash data reports from Jeeps himself, ones that have been in accidents and ones that are just on the road driving around. And he's checking those to see if there are discrepancies in the way the Jeep reports mileage before and after a crash, which, hey, he's testing the hypothesis here because does it have a discrepancy or not? Also, let's say this Jeep did get into an accident and did roll into this ravine. What if the wheels were still turning? What if Daniel's foot was still on the gas? Could that rack up mileage? Or was the Jeep in a wreck? You know, let's say somebody ran him off the road or ran into him and then took advantage of him and then drove the Jeep away from the scene of the crime and then staged an accident somewhere else that was 7 to 11 miles away from where the initial incident happened. There's two ways to look at that.
Right. And their private investigator, Jeff McGrath, fully believes that this was staged. But that's what I find curious here. If you're trying to stage something, who would have the motivation to do that? And that gave me great pause here because why would Daniel Robinson want to make it look like there was foul play? I mean, after all, what do we have here to suggest there could be foul play? We have a, what does it look like, red paint to you on the vehicle? That's unexplained. That could have been from someone hitting his vehicle. So yeah, if Daniel was just going to go missing and maybe he did it on his own, then you'd think it would make more sense if he just left the vehicle somewhere. Attacking him and then making this thing roll down into a ravine, a 20-foot ravine, I don't see how that helps anyone cover up this crime. It actually makes it look more like foul play than it otherwise would, my opinion. Now, this crash data report also shows that the seatbelt, the driver's side seatbelt, was engaged during this time, during the accident. So that means, I guess we would infer, that there was a driver, that someone was in the vehicle and was belted in.
Again, is this one accident or several accidents? Was somebody belted in at the time another vehicle hit the Jeep and then it was pushed into this ravine? Or was the ravine rollover the only accident that happened and Daniel or somebody was in the Jeep when it rolled over? You got to look at it both ways.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood. that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
When they found the Jeep, it was very odd. His clothes and wallet were outside of the Jeep in a pile. His cell phone and keys were inside of the vehicle. And one of his boots was found underneath the vehicle. That's odd because why would he take his clothing off outside of the Jeep like this? Now, I know when people have hypothermia, I know when people have, say, drugs in their system, sometimes they do strip off their clothes. But in this case, I don't know if it's really cold enough at night for him to suffer from hypothermia. And we don't know if he had any drugs in his system, but he had no history of drug use that we could find. So we don't have enough information here.
Well, I did look up temperatures in that area online on multiple websites, and it didn't look like it got colder than 70 degrees. So even if you drop that another 10 degrees, no one's going to get hypothermia out there. Robinson had been in that area for what, a couple of years or so? I mean, he moved to Arizona from South Carolina, where his family was at, in 2019. I wouldn't think that he would know a lot about the desert. Maybe he did.
So obviously, his family is looking at this. They're looking at paint on the Jeep. They're looking at the evidence around the Jeep, his pile of clothing and his wallet, and the fact that it appears the Jeep had been driven and started after this accident. So they're thinking this is very suspicious and it looks like foul play, or they could consider foul play. And of course, anytime you have law enforcement not giving you the response that you want, the family's going to look at that and think, well, maybe there is something more to this. It's our loved one and we want more attention, and they're not looking at the bigger picture here. They're just disregarding this as a missing person or an adult that just felt like taking off. What other evidence do we have to look at here on the day of his disappearance?
There was a police report released, and there were multiple people that were either friends of Daniel's or family members, and even a waitress at a Waffle House that he had visited 2 days before he disappeared, who had reported odd behavior from him. Now, remember, these are people that kind of know him or know him very well, and they're using terms like Daniel was off. So on the same day that he disappeared, he had texted his sister that he had had an emergency. So she started calling him and texting him, but he never responded. And his sister also said that one time he was over at her apartment and just sat there for about 30 minutes. He didn't say or do anything. He just sat there, and then he finally got up and left. But I would say the big story here, Justin, is a woman named Caitlin.
Daniel had talked about a woman to his family. He had talked about somebody he was pursuing, and they'd never met this person. They had no idea who he was talking about, right?
Right. And this was someone that he was saying that he was in love with.
So I would think this is a big deal, but they're only able to track down possibly one person, one female that he might have been talking to.
Well, he was saying he was in love with a woman. And when his dad had asked him questions about her, he said his son didn't really appear to know anything about her, which he thought was strange. And then there was a coworker who told the police that Daniel had mentioned something about a girl, saying it was a woman he liked but couldn't have. And this is someone he made contact with prior to his disappearance. See, Daniel was an Instacart delivery person, and that's how he met her. So when he had taken her food, she invited him into her home. And that's because, according to her, he seemed real friendly. She even exchanged phone numbers with him. But that's where things took a turn, because according to Caitlin, Daniel started just showing up unannounced at her house several times and even told her that he loved her. According to Caitlin, Daniel said, "Do you hate me?" And her reply was, "I don't hate you, but please leave me alone." This is where he took 15 hours to respond. And that was 18 hours before he disappeared. So according to Caitlin, Daniel was making her aware of his interest in her, but she didn't know it was going to escalate like this. She thought he was nice and friendly and wanted to get to know him a little better, but he was basically stalking her. And so she was like, I'm not doing this.
This is somebody he had just met, I would say barely knew, but he's mentioning this person to his family. He's mentioning this person to other people as if it's something, I would say, more than it was. I would just categorize that as more of his off behavior. And then you have, you know, this waitress at the diner saying he was acting off. You have his sister and you have his coworker the day of. Is this something we can say is absolutely foul play, like somebody ran him off the road and then took advantage of the situation? Or is this Daniel was in crisis, maybe a mental health crisis? He wasn't thinking straight, because I don't think robbery was the motive here, because his wallet was there, stuff was there. But I'm looking at this and I'm thinking he's behaving strangely, and they find his vehicle just miles away, and he was driving in a direction that he shouldn't have been. There's questions there. And regardless of whether this was foul play or not, it's still important to look at this, because we're finding this stuff out now. But in the first 24, 48 hours, nobody knows what's going on. Nobody knows if it is foul play. Nobody knows if it is a mental health crisis. I mean, this Daniel situation reminds me a lot of the Brandon Lawson situation, where it's something's wrong here and we don't know what it is, but Daniel obviously needed help. And who knows if that help came sooner, if it would have changed anything, but we need to at least try.
I understand that people look at this case and they say, well, looking at the vehicle or looking at his behavior, then we kind of have to make a decision. Is it that simple? Maybe he drives deeper into the desert because he is upset about Caitlin. Maybe he feels embarrassed. I know that's one possibility. Maybe he gets in this wreck and he hits his head real hard. Now, no blood was found in the vehicle. So some people say, well, maybe he didn't really hit his head. You can hit your head and not leave blood behind.
My cousin hit her head a couple weeks ago, got a concussion. And let me just put it this way. She's not in a bad state, but she is a different person with this concussion. She didn't break the skin or anything, but her entire personality has shifted. Head injuries are no joke, but did this head injury with Daniel happen prior to his disappearance? The day of his disappearance?
So the way I look at it, I see a young guy who is going through some things, and I don't think he's very happy. And so what does that say in this case? Well, number one, it means that people should not give up on him. They should keep looking. I don't think anybody needs to be dissuaded from doing the right thing here. But when we take into account his behavior before he went missing, it says like what you had said, he needed help. I don't blame anybody for supposed lack of action here leading up to his disappearance, because, you know, we all have bad days. But how many times do you think, oh, someone's having a bad day, I better intervene and keep with them and make sure nothing happens? That's not how we think. You know, we're not looking at everything in such a negative light. But I do think it's possible that he wasn't himself. And all it takes is for things to start going downhill. I mean, we're only as good as our best day, you know, and if we have a day that's just like what his seemed to be, where he had put a lot into being with Caitlin, well, I don't know. I just, I don't know that you could say it's because a girl turned him down. I think there's more to it than that. But this could have been the catalyst that sent him spiraling. Maybe that's why he wasn't able to respond to people normally. But Justin, there's a question about this because David Robinson has been advocating for his son from the get-go. And he says that there's new information that a law enforcement officer spoke with Daniel, who seemed to be of clear mind and was able to talk with him that day.
So it's, if he is of clear mind, then what would be the problem here? And that would be more foul play. But a lot of the details in this case are disputed, whether it be the crash data report or how a law enforcement officer interpreted his interaction with Daniel. But why is that information coming out so much later that a law enforcement officer had spoken to him? Again, it's hard to reconcile that.
Obviously, David Robinson wants to know what happened to his son. He's been giving updates to the media. He had told them that he's staying in basically a studio apartment while he's in Arizona searching for his son. He organizes searches, and it's been now, as of this recording, 6 months basically since his son went missing. And up till now, he's been saying he's held out the belief that his son is still out there. Now he says if his son didn't leave the desert, he believes that's unlikely, that his son is alive. But he also thinks that it's possible that his son may have left the desert and is in the city somewhere. And so he is also involved in organizing searches in the cities because he believes it's possible that he's still out there.
Now, during this time, Aaron, they're searching this area, they're scouring the desert, and they found some remains. They found a human skull, but the police, what did they say about this skull that they found?
Well, this skull was discovered on July 31st. All the police had to say about it was that it was later determined not to belong to Daniel. So this skull was found on the 31st, and the Jeep that Daniel was driving was discovered on July 19th. That was actually discovered by a landowner.
So it's always interesting when they're doing a search for one person that they can find evidence or remains of others. And I hope that possibly this might solve another case that needs help. So that's all I can hope with that one. But wow, I'm sure it was hard for the family to think that they might have had some closure and then be told that it wasn't their son.
For those asking why Daniel Robinson hasn't been located yet, deceased or otherwise, I would say it took almost a month for them to locate a Jeep Renegade. So think about that. I know there's this idea that it was placed there later, but it was pretty banged up. And if it's placed in a 20-foot ravine like that, you know, you could be walking through the area and not notice it. I mean, it depends on where you're at. And we're talking about a huge amount of land here. So it's not so easy just to say, well, we had people out there. It's not that easy. And there are many, many cases where people went missing and people went through an area. And in that same area, that person's remains were later discovered. So this is a huge undertaking.
And it took them close to 3 months to get the crash data report off of the Jeep. Nothing moves fast here. Go out to our social media, TikTok, Instagram, or even Patreon, and let us know what you think. Go out and read about some of these cases, go through the evidence, and let us know what you think of these cases and what you think happened to these two men.
If you have any information on Daniel Robinson, please visit the website, pleasehelpfinddaniel.com, or you can call 803-200-7994. Well, I certainly hope the families find answers. Never miss an episode of Generation Y. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you're listening right now. Also, be sure to follow us on social media. Our TikTok is at Gen Y Pod. Our Instagram is at Generation Y Podcast. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.